busted flat in Baton Rouge, waiting for a train, and I was feeling near as faded as my jeans. Bobby thumbed a diesel down just before it rained.
Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Rock Review. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about rock and roll music from such sources as The News and Observer, The Week Magazine, The Independent, New York Times, Rolling Stone Magazine, and Entertainment Weekly.
Freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing. I mean nothing, hon, if it ain't free.
This opening, Me and Bobby McGee, brought to us by Janis Joplin. We'll be hearing more about and from Janis Joplin later on in today's program, and she'll close it out as well. But first, these trivia questions. Our trivia questions come to us today from www.classicbands.com. Question number one. During his presidential campaign in 2000, George W. Bush was asked by Oprah Winfrey what his favorite song was. What was his reply? Was it A, Born in the USA by Bruce Springsteen? B, Wake Up Little Susie by Buddy Holly? C, Come Together by the Beatles? D, Tiptoe Through the Tulips by Tiny Tim, or E, I Don't Really Have a Favorite Song. Question number two. As a child, this rock artist's mother told him that dogs could pick up vibrations from people, so that a dog would bark at bad vibrations. In 1966, this artist turned that idea into a number one hit, Good Vibrations. What was the artist's name? And what group performed this 1966 hit? Hint, here's a snippet from one of that group's other hits.
Aruba, Jamaica, ooh, I wanna take ya. Bermuda, Bahama, come on, pretty mama. Key Largo, Montego, baby, why don't we go? Jamaica, off the Florida Keys. There's a place called Kokomo. That's where you wanna go to get away from it all.
Who is this group and what was that artist's name? The answers to these two very important trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. But first, these transitions. The transition section of today's program comes to us once again from BGORecords.com, today in rock history. And today is the weekend of February 26 and 27. What were the number one hits this weekend? Well, back a half a century ago this weekend, it was Chubby Checker at number one with Pony Time. And 45 years ago this weekend, it was Nancy Sinatra, These Boots Are Made for Walking at number one. And back in 1977 this weekend, it was the Eagles, New Kid in Town at number one. And back in 1983, Michael Jackson's Thriller was the number one hit this weekend. If you were born on February 26, you share a birthday with Antoine Domino, also known as Fats Domino. He was born on February 26, 1928, as was Johnny Cash, February 26, 1932, and Michael Bolton, February 26, 1954. Or if you were born on February 27th, you share a B-Day with Neil Schon of Santana and Journey, 1954, and Adrian Smith of Iron Maiden, born on February 27th, 1957. Miscellany in rock history this weekend. Well, back in 1954, it was U.S. Representative Ruth Thompson of Michigan proposing a bill to ban the mailing or transportation of any obscene, lewd, lascivious, or filthy disc or any other article capable of producing sound. This was a thinly disguised attempt to stem the growth of R&B. And back in 1955, a year later, Billboard announces that for the very first time, 7-inch 45 RPM singles are outselling 78s in the U.S. Back in 1955, that same year, this weekend, Laverne Baker appeals to Congress in the hopes of revising the 1909 Copyright Act so that artists can be protected against note-for-note cover versions of black hits by white acts. And this weekend, back in 1990, Milli Vanilli singer Rob Politis states in Time magazine, "I'm the new Elvis. Mick Jagger can't produce a sound. Musically, we're more talented than any Bob Dylan or Paul McCartney." Within months, Milli Vanilli would be exposed as lip-syncing frauds, and the Grammy they won for Best New Artist would be withdrawn. This final transitions piece comes to us from Daily Variety, published on February 8, 2011, by Christopher Morris. Gary Moore. Guitarist Gary Moore, who did three tours of duty with the Irish rock band Thin Lizzy, was found dead Sunday in Spain. He was 58 years old. Moore's manager, Adam Parsons, told the BBC that the musician died in a hotel in Estepona on the Costa del Sol. The Spanish Interior Ministry is awaiting the outcome of an autopsy to determine whether an investigation into the musician's death is necessary. Article skips down and ends with this. Moore also recorded with bassist Greg Lake of King Crimson and Emerson, Lake & Palmer, and with BBM, a trio featuring ex-Cream members Jack Bruce and Ginger Baker. Best known as a blues interpreter, he recorded prolifically from the early 1980s on, releasing nearly 30 solo albums. This next article, entitled General's Good Time Music, Got Us Past Some Bad Times, comes to us from the News and Observer, published on the 15th of January, 2011, by Barry Saunders. Today is January 15, so it's no surprise that people are gathering in Raleigh to honor a man who helped make the world a better place for all people. No, not Martin Luther King Jr. His birthday is today, but the holiday is Monday. Today, they're going to be paying tribute to General Norman Johnson, who, along with his group, the chairman of the board, has helped bridge gulfs between people of all races and ages. Johnson died October 13. Tonight, at Raleigh's Lincoln Theater, the remaining board members, Ken Knox and Danny Woods, along with the Embers and Jim Quick and Coastline, will come together for a tribute to Johnson. Giving a musical group credit for improving the world could be construed as hyperbole until you hear the chairman's music and hear what people say about it. Knox couldn't recall just who wrote a specific story on the group decades ago, but he remembers what it said. The writer asked, "What do Martin Luther King Jr. and the chairman of the board have in common?" The answer was that we both bring people together, Knox recalled when I spoke with him last week. If you doubt that, just talk to Harry Rogers of Charlotte. When I spoke with Rogers, a retired Charlotte firefighter, he was embarrassed and surprised by all the attention he has gotten since Johnson's death. It's not hard to understand why his story resonates, though. In a 2006 letter to Johnson and his bandmates, Rogers told how in 1970 he was guarding six Viet Cong prisoners of war in South Vietnam when Armed Forces Radio played the chairman of the board's first hit, "Give Me Just a Little More Time." It wasn't the first time that I'd heard it, he wrote, but this time I noticed one of the prisoners was not singing but was lip-syncing the words, even the part that goes, "And our love will surely grow." Brrrt. I asked him if he spoke English, and he told me that he had attended the University of Michigan. The prisoner also told Rogers that North Vietnamese soldiers held AK-47 assault rifles to his wife's, father's, and mother's heads and forced him to serve in their army. The Duke complied, of course, but told Rogers he got captured as soon as he could. That day, Rogers wrote, instead of being the inhuman animals that had been trained, even brainwashed, to believe, I saw my enemy as being human beings. I believe that event helped me to overcome prejudice more than any other single lesson in my life. You guys clearly had a part in that experience. You didn't have to go to the jungles of Southeast Asia to see the group's impact, though. Knox speaks wistfully of the interracial harmony he has witnessed on Myrtle Beach's Grand Strand and elsewhere when the band performs. I reckon it is pretty hard to hate somebody when you're shagging to Carolina Girls or 39-21-40 Shape, a song that prolific Johnson wrote when he was 14, and which more than any other sums up what's on the average 14-year-old boy's mind. Prior to Johnson's death, the group was still performing as many as 250 dates a year, Knox said. Its heyday, though, was undoubtedly the early 1970s, a period of anti-war and civil rights turmoil. Article skips down. It is for their beach music that General, his real name, and the board will forever be remembered. After listening to four or five of their Sun and Sand classics, I almost felt the need to shake the sand out of my shoes, even though the sand outside my office is frozen solid. Johnson, Knox, and Woods are so associated with beach music that it's a shock to learn the group is from Detroit. General told us, let's go down to the Carolinas and play some beach music, Knox recalled. I thought he meant like Jan and Dean and the Beach Boys, but he explained that beach music is R&B music played on the coast. In an interview, Johnson once described beach music as the black music young white kids listened to when they got to the beach and away from, presumably, their disapproving parents. Although they're not from here, Knox said, we're adopted now. We're in the North Carolina and the South Carolina Music Halls of Fame. Whatever you call it, and wherever they're from, their music captured the zeitgeist of the early 1970s better than anything this side of that yellow, smiley face, have a nice day sticker. It has also helped us all have a nicer day together. This next article comes to us from the News and Observer, published on the 17th of February, 2011, entitled Brown Cooper to Play Benefit in Tucson, Arizona. Tucson. Jackson Brown, Alice Cooper, David Crosby, and Graham Nash will perform in Tucson, Arizona, to benefit a charitable fund established after the shooting there that killed 6 people and wounded 13 others. Astronaut Mark Kelly, the husband of wounded U.S. Rep. Gabrielle Giffords, plans to speak at the event. It will benefit the Fund for Civility, Respect, and Understanding. Wounded Giffords aide Rob Barber stated the fund is to support people affected by the January 8th shooting was started by him and to hold events promoting community unity.
You and me ain't no movie star. What we are is what we are. We share a bed, some loving and TV, yeah. That's enough for a working man. But what I am is what I am. And I tell you, babe, well, that's enough for me.
Alice Cooper. So what do you know about this featured artist for today, Janis Joplin? Well, we see this article published in www.classicbands.com. Janis Joplin was born January 19, 1943, in Port Arthur, Texas. Her father was an oil refinery worker, and her mother was a registrar at a business college. Though her family was middle class, as a teenager she showed signs of the unconventional woman she would become. She was something of a loner, and unlike her siblings and neighbors' peers, she listened to folk and blues music. Joplin's favorite artists included Odetta and Leadbelly. and she was greatly influenced by them in her own vocal style. By the time she was 17, she had decided to become a singer and left home. At first, Joplin found work in country and western clubs in Houston and other Texas cities like Austin, with the goal of saving enough money from her gigs for bus fare to California. She enrolled in several different colleges while singing folk songs for little money, but her attempts at continuing her education never lasted long. She also tried living in various communes and eventually settled in San Francisco for a few years. Article skips down. Though Joplin had not had much experience singing rock music, the combination of her gravelly, bluesy voice with Big Brother's hard rock sound was a success. The group quickly became popular in the San Francisco area, and by the time the Monterey International Pop Festival took place in 67 in Monterey, California, Big Brother and the Holding Company were a featured attraction, getting top billing over veterans Booker T and the MGs and newcomers the Iron Butterfly. Joplin's performances at this festival and at Woodstock in 1969 are considered by many specialists in the music of the late 60s to have been classic moments in the history of rock. The article skips down. Increasingly, Joplin was the member of the Big Brother who was singled out for critical acclaim. For instance, a Village Voice reviewer lauded one of her concert performances thus: "She sure projects. She jumps and runs and pounces, vibrating the audience with solid sound. The range of her earthy, dynamic voice seems almost without limits." With critiques like that, it's not surprising that Joplin left Big Brother to go solo in 1968, soon after the group recorded their second album, Cheap Thrills. From that LP came the band's first success on the singles chart, when Pieces of My Heart reached number 12 in November. Here then, Piece of My Heart. Joplin's last album was 1970's Pearl, the nickname the singer's closest friends called her. Besides her acclaimed version of Christofferson's Me and Bobby McGee, Pearl included cuts like Get It While You Can, which she considered one of her theme songs, Cry Baby, and the humorous Mercedes-Benz, a song she composed herself. It seemed like everything was going well for Janis Joplin when on October 4th, 1970, her body was found in the Landmark Motor Hotel in Hollywood, California. She had died the day before from an overdose of heroin. The publicity over Joplin's rough-and-tumble blues mama lifestyle nearly overwhelmed the heartfelt music she made. But years after her death, she is remembered as the best white blues singer of the 1960s. The commercial success that had eluded her in life became, in 1971, when Me and Bobby McGee was awarded a gold record. Had Janis Joplin lived, she would have turned 68 this year. She was only 27 years old when she died. Janis Joplin today sells more than 300,000 copies a year of her albums, tapes, and CDs. In the first major biography of Janis Joplin in two decades comes a new book titled Love Janis, written by Laura Joplin, Janis's kid sister. It's a fascinating look at one of rock's all-time legends, featuring 25 never-before-seen letters from Janis to her family. They reveal her impressions of the early San Francisco rock scene and her thoughts on her rising stardom and subsequent fame. And we happen to have Janis's sister Laura, played by Christine T, here in the studio with us. This is from Gary James' interview with Janis Joplin's sister, Laura Joplin, published in www.classicbands.com.
Summer time, time.
It must have been very sad for you to sit down and write a book like this.
Well, you know, dealing with Janice's death and accepting her death was a big step for me. But once I dealt with it and got past it, once I let go of that grief, I didn't grieve about things anymore, and I was free to enjoy the person. So writing this book was a very joyous experience. Certainly I had moments of pain and anguish when I'd encounter something, but for the most part, it was a wonderfully rewarding experience, and I felt much closer to her and like I know her better now than I did before I started.
Laura, what prompted you to write this book?
Properly, the main factor was my participation in the Port Arthur, that's a place in Texas, Memorial Celebration in 1988. We were getting ready to go down there. We were gathering things they wanted to put on exhibit on Janice. That's when we ran across Janice's letters. I was thoroughly just bowled over by it, the letters. They brought back Janice to me, our relationship, the quality of her conversation, the intimacy of her communication. There wasn't any fuzziness from memory. It was real fresh. So it was that emotional experience.
When Janice was at the peak of her fame, was it hard to be her sister, living in Port Arthur? What did people say to you?
Oh, there were different types of comments. People were excited and asking what she's doing now, and when the record's coming out, so there was a kind of enthusiasm. I don't remember people saying anything negative. I think the effect of Janice's fame was as strong while she was living as it was actually after she died on me anyway. That was perhaps because I was more sensitive after she died.
Were your parents proud of Janice's success? Did they invite friends over to the house to watch her on TV?
They invited people over to watch her on the Ed Sullivan Show. Clearly, my parents were very proud of Janice. But also my parents were a member of their generation, and they didn't understand the hippie movement any more than the rest of her generation. They had an honest relationship with Janice. They worried about what Janice was getting into, and all parents worry about what their kids are doing.
Did Janice ever introduce you to any of the big rock stars of the day, Jim Morrison, Hendrix?
We didn't really travel around with Janice. I know we've met some famous people here and there, but when you meet them, they just look more like ordinary people. We went out to San Francisco and the Avalon Ballroom, but that was in 1967 before any of them were superstars.
Were Joe Namath and Dick Cavett boyfriends of Janice's?
I've heard some rumors linking Janice with Joe Namath. I think she definitely met him and probably went out with him, but I don't think they had a serious relationship. Certainly she enjoyed Dick Cavett's shows and was on several of them, but I'm not sure about anything beyond that. They are both very literate people, so I'm sure that they would have enjoyed each other's company, but I don't think there were any romances that I know of.
At what age do you think she decided to become a professional singer?
Well, I'm not sure if Janice sat down and made a career choice. Music was the way of life. The fact that she actually made some money at it, here and there, was just that much better. I think she had aspirations to be wonderful, but I'm sure that any singer publicly performing has those kind of aspirations. Janice was a gifted singer and lucky enough to be at the right place at the right time, when her music was able to catch the spotlight and allow her to achieve artistic stardom.
Feeling good was good enough for me. Good enough for me and my Bobby.
So how did Janice meet Chet Helms, the gentleman who gave her her first big break?
Well, Janice went to school in Austin for a while and played music there and hung out with a group of people that played music. Chet Helms was a Texan and a former University of Texas student who was passing through town and hanging out with the people. He was living in San Francisco at the time and mentioned to all the musicians in Austin, in particular Janice, that if they came to San Francisco, they'd be big hits, because San Francisco was really hunting for the kind of roots music that Austin had. Janice listened and went out there. They actually hitchhiked together to get out there. A few years later, Chet mentioned that Big Brother and the Holding Company, a band that he managed, was hunting for a singer, and would she be interested? Two of the guys in Big Brother knew Janice because they had been in North Beach playing the same folk music club that Janice had been in.
Were Janice's schoolmates cruel to her, as has been reported elsewhere?
She had some difficulties with some people in school, but not the entire school. I don't think she was picked on, but she did feel like an outsider. She couldn't identify with the same goals and desires that a lot of her classmates had, so she felt an alienation. But she wasn't alone. I think that every adolescent feels a certain amount of frustration and discomfort in high school. Some of the comments Janice put putting the hometown down or high school have to be understood with the context of the 60s. It was a time when there was a huge division line being drawn. You were either hip or you were straight. And once you crossed the line and became hip, it was important to put down the single world, straight world.
Yeah, it's interesting. What did Janice think of Woodstock?
She came right after Woodstock. I remember it because of what it's become. She was just incredibly enthusiastic, just bubbling away, jumping up and down, and talking about how incredible it was. It was kind of sad that none of us could relate to it. You know, the kind of tremendous moment it's come to symbolize? We just thought it was a rock concert, another group of kids listening to music. We didn't understand. Slowly, it began to dawn us when we began seeing the pictures. She tried to share her enthusiasm, what was going on, but our life experience was such that we couldn't understand it.
Political import. It goes like this. Oh, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz? My friends all drive Porsches. I must make amends. Worked hard all my lifetime. No help.
Finally, Laura, what goes through your mind when you're driving your car down the road with the radio on and a song of Janice's comes on?
Well, it's a funny process when I listen to stuff, and certainly hers. I've listened to her music a lot. The first thing that comes to my mind is, oh yeah, I like that song. Then the second level kind of comes in and I go, oh, golly, she has a great voice. The third level just somehow takes over and I just have to sing along with her. It's just really compelling kind of feeling. It's funny.
Well, thank you, Christine T., for playing the role of Laura Joplin in that very interesting interview about her sister, Janice Joplin. So how did you do on today's trivia questions? Question number one, once again, had to do with George W. Bush and his reply to Oprah Winfrey when asked what his favorite song was. In an appearance on the Oprah Winfrey Show during the 2000 U.S. presidential election, Governor George W. Bush named Wake Up, Little Susie as his favorite song, so that was answer B. But he erroneously claimed that it was by Buddy Holly. Holly never recorded that song. And question number two had to do with Bad Vibrations and the number one hit, Good Vibrations, that was a result of that. Well, it turns out that Brian Wilson's mother was the person who planted the seed for this number one hit, Good Vibrations, for the Beach Boys in 1966 with her comment about dogs picking up bad vibrations. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Rock Review. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until next time.
Cause I could use some coffee.